From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour is made in cities where new luxury apartments are constructed. That's just about everywhere. And there's a debate among community members, urbanists, and economists about the impact of high-end housing, especially when it comes to the supply of affordable housing. Here's the breakdown. Skeptics of new market rate construction, and that's sometimes a euphemism for luxury apartments, they say building high-end units in already wealthy areas only further segregates communities. But advocates in the YIMBY, or Yes in My Backyard, movement say building luxury housing frees up more units for everyone, including working class and lower income families. It's described in by urban planning researcher Nolan Gray as a musical chairs type situation. Writing for CityLab, he details research that argues new units will ease up demand for existing housing, where the older housing gradually becomes more affordable. And this, he says, will reduce displacement among vulnerable communities. The research Gray is referring to comes from an economist named Evan Mast at the W.E. Upjohn Institute for Employment Research. Mast studied 802 new multifamily developments in 12 different cities and followed the moving history of residents in those new units. Here's more from CityLab. Quote, his model suggests that for every 100 luxury units built in wealthier neighborhoods, as many as 48 households in moderate-income neighborhoods are able to move into housing that better suits their needs, vacating an existing unit in the process. Somewhere between 10 and 20 of these households are coming from among the city's lowest-income neighborhoods, vacating units and reducing demand where housing is most likely to be affordable for working families, end quote. So do the economists' findings provide a glimmer of hope for the affordable housing crisis in America? Or, as some critics say, is that too simplistic of a view? Our guests weigh in on those questions, which come as local developers build, yes, new high-end apartments across the city. And this hour, our panel discusses the research and the possible impact of, call it market rate, what are we going to call it? Luxury housing, whatever you want to call it, that's on all of those signs we see right off 490. Kent Gardner is here, an economist with the Center for Governmental Research. Kent, welcome. Thanks for being here.
Nice to be here, Rick.
And also with us is Don Riley, Vice President of Mark IV Enterprises. Nice to see you. And I think I saw your sign right off 490 near Goodman, right?
We've got a beautiful new project under construction, 625 Goodman. We're calling it.
Okay. Well, a lot to talk about with both of our guests, but first I want to turn to Evan Mast, an economist with the W.E. Upjohn Institute for Employment Research, and it was his work that prompted that CityLab article. I had a conversation with him this morning and asked him to start with this analogy of either a ripple effect when you've got new high-end apartments, new high-end housing, the ripple effect on different incomes, different people looking to rent, to own in a city, and how he views it. Let's listen.
I think the easiest way to explain it is to sort of go with an example. So I'll give you an example based on one of my friends here in Chicago. You know, suppose that you put up a new rental building and it's pretty expensive. One bedrooms are going for like $2,500 a month. I think people look at that and they're like, well, how's that new building ever going to help me afford my rent? It's too expensive. But the thing is, you know, I have a friend that moved into one of these buildings and she came from different building, older building, where she was paying about $1,800 for her one bedroom. So about $700 less than the rent in the new building. And when she moves out of her old apartment, that opens up a new vacancy at that cheaper price point. And you might say, yeah, sure, but you know, $1,800, that's still not cheap. But you could imagine that this process keeps going. So it might be the case that the person who moves into my friend's old apartment comes from an apartment that was only like $1,400. And the person that moves into that person's old apartment building comes from a cheaper apartment still. And it ends up being that because you built this fancy new building, you set off this whole chain of moves and it eventually opened up a space in a much cheaper apartment than the new building that you actually put up. I mean, what I do in my paper is basically take this data on where people move and show that this example I gave you isn't just like an anomaly or some weird anecdote. It seems to happen all the time when you put up new units. So I find that when you build a new expensive multifamily building, this chain of migration reaches an area with below average income like 70% of the time. So it's more often than not that when you track this chain, you end up hitting, you know, what we would consider a lower income area. So typically, you know, these fancy new units are going to actually loosen the market. in those lower income areas.
Okay, and this is where I think I want to make sure I understand how this chain of movement might work, because I certainly understand the idea that when a new building, let's say a new set of luxury apartments comes into an area, that increases the overall housing stock. It increases at the high end, and people who were previously in one set of market rate apartments might move up for them, and others might move. But what's not clear to me is how everyone is moving, because it's not necessarily impacting incomes. People still, I assume, have the same amount of income and access to the kinds of funds they need to live where they're living.
Yeah, so I think a good way to think about it is to imagine that you own an older apartment building with about 100 units. And let's say that you manage to set rent at $1,500, and that keeps your apartment just about full. But then suppose, you know, we build this fancy new building nearby and 20 of your tenants move into that building. So now you've got all these vacancies in your apartment. You have to figure out how to fill them. And your $1,500 rent might be too high now. And you might have to lower that to $1,400 to actually attract people to move into your building and keep it filled up. So that's how it ends up increasing people's take-home pay, is because, you know, to keep their buildings filled up, landlords are going to have to lower rents, and that's going to, you know, translate into higher take-home pay for people that live in those buildings.
Okay. And so my last question for you then is simply how you view this research in context of housing policy. I ask that because I'm sure all researchers, all economists, everyone wants more research, bigger sample sizes, more confirmation, more repetition. And I'm sure there's going to be more work to do to kind of replicate what you're finding. But let's just assume that what you find is entirely valid. And it is now incumbent upon policymakers to do what? What do you think needs to shift, or is, especially when it comes to the desire to see more, quote, affordable housing? What does your research indicate for policymakers?
I think in the current debate, there's often, you know, these market strategies where you say, let developers build, are often pitted in like direct opposition to things like subsidized housing or voucher programs or other kinds of income supports. It's sort of pitched as one or the other. And I think what this research suggests is that, you know, these market-based things, they have an effect on affordability. They're going to help a lot of lower income households, and we should do them. But, you know, that doesn't mean they're the only thing that we should do. We should think more about how to do these two different types of policies in conjunction. And I think actually, you know, the city of Rochester provides a good example of why you need to do both of these things. You know, if you think about really low income neighborhoods where people are struggling to make rent, we're sort of, you know, in some ways places where we most want to improve housing affordability for people. A lot of these neighborhoods already have really high vacancy rates. You know, they have units or houses that are being abandoned. You know, their population might have declined a lot in the last 20 years. So it doesn't really make sense that creating more vacancies in those areas is somehow going to lower prices. And I think that's really where you point to a role for, you know, these other things like voucher programs and subsidized housing, is for these areas that it's sort of unclear how these market kind of market mechanisms that I've explained could help lower prices there.
That is Evan Mast, an economist who wrote this study with the W.E. Upjohn Institute for Employment Research, and you can find more in the City Lab piece that has us talking this hour. All right, Kent Gardner, an economist with the Center for Governmental Research, how do you grade what you heard from the economist there?
Oh, I think he's right on target, you know, particularly if you think about the things he said towards the end. I mean, you know, first, housing policies are complicated, and we're not going to solve the housing problem in Rochester just by building stuff. That's true for most markets. It's certainly true for those very hotly contested markets like, you know, the San Francisco area and much of New York City. But you need a combination of policies that are going to ensure that you actually benefit people all along the income spectrum. But the other point, and I think you actually raised that in the interview, is that, you know, just as the housing market study that was released by the city last year says, well, what we have in Rochester isn't a supply problem, it's an income problem. And so if we don't deal with the income problem, you know, we've got a lot of housing. We don't, you know, it's not that more housing doesn't help on the margins, but if you're taking a look at people who are trying to find an apartment for $500, $400, Maybe even $600. We really have to deal with the housing stock that we have and look at those vacant houses and try to make sure that we're supporting the very low end of the market.
Okay, and so in that tail end of the interview, when he's talking about having to do sort of both, the kind of the both and approach to a housing stock, understanding that in some of the really low income neighborhoods in any community, that this policy at the top end is not maybe going to come all the way down to impact them. What are the kinds of things? He talked about vouchers, subsidized housing. I mean, are there any policies that you think are really working?
Well, I think that it's important to be careful about demolition and abandonment. Again, we have a lot of houses in Rochester that are on the margins, are close to being vacant, are vacant or close to being demolished. I think we have to recognize we've got a housing stock there. If there are ways we can bring these houses up to code without it costing more than the house is worth, that adds housing stock to the extent we can allow accessory apartments. That certainly can help the market as well. I think we also have to be careful about how we zone, even at the upper end. I mean, you can zone in an exclusionary fashion that makes it more likely that the product that's going to be put on the market is going to be more expensive rather than less. Again, we're not trying to build these, 75-story high-rises that we talk about in San Francisco or Manhattan, which are very expensive to build. But at the same time, zoning policies, building codes can influence the kind of housing that gets introduced. And I'm sure that Don has a lot more to say about that than I would, because he lives in that world.
Well, and in a moment, we're going to turn to Don for what Mark Forrest is doing. And it's not just 625 Goodman, but I mean,
right.
I think
right.
that's a good example of something that people are seeing right now.
Right. So,
but before I turn to Don specifically, a couple more broad-based questions here.
Sure.
So this is where I'm going to try to put my student hat on here and try to stay with the economics lesson. And if I go off the rails, that's why you're here. When Evan Mast talks about housing prices sort of down the chain impacted, somebody who's paying $1,400 a month moves, and now someone who was paying a different amount moves into that $1,400. But that's because also landlords and people who own these buildings are changing what they can price these at. The idea is that the broad-based effect, whether it's a 625 Goodman or anything, the broad-based effect is to bring prices down. In individual neighborhoods, though, is it possible that if what people often will call gentrification, can prices go up? That if we see a project that is successful and a little glamorous and luxurious, that we could see surrounding prices be pulled upward?
Well, that's certainly true, and it happens all the time. The challenge is that we want to improve the value of rental housing, but we don't want to increase the price of rental housing. That's kind of a hard formula. And that's the nub for gentrification. We want the quality of a neighborhood to get better, to become more desirable, but as a consequence of it becoming more desirable, it gets more expensive. And, again, the way to fix that is with something that addresses incomes, and that's where vouchers come in.
Okay, and the last sort of general question is, because you're here, and I don't think we've talked about Bob Morgan enough. Don't worry, Don. I'm asking Kent about this.
No.
What I want to ask you about this, Kent, is this is a very much a layman's read on trying to understand what's going on here. But Bob Morgan is and his firm is has a lot of units in our community at a lot of different prices. We've heard from people renting who are concerned about their futures with this. What I'm wondering is, when at least what the evidence seems to tell us is, the representation from Bob Morgan's team was, well, we were at 97% occupancy when they were at 70% or 60-something percent, and that they weren't booming the way they thought. Can we keep building in this way? I mean, should we stop for a second and say, whoa, I don't know. If we didn't have the occupancy that they claimed for a while, can you build yourself into a corner? And how do you know when you're going to get there? How do you figure that out?
Yeah, I think the fact that Bob Morgan was overextended and that Bob Morgan was allegedly, yes, thank you, and was playing fast and loose, apparently playing fast and loose,
allegedly,
with his lenders to encourage them to give him more money doesn't mean that these weren't viable projects. Morgan has a lot of great projects, and I think again, I'm not a developer, but But I am sure that pretty much every developer finds him or herself in an awkward position where a property is moving along and you need some more cash to keep it going. And, you know, you need to go to the lender and get some more cash, except if you really tell the truth, if you really tell them exactly what's going on, maybe the lender, you know, looks at your cross-eyed and says, well, I don't know that I'm going to give you that much money. So for a guy like Morgan, who was expanding as rapidly as he was and investing as heavily as he was, you know, that those occasions happen more often. And one suspects that it starts moving from white lies to gray lies to black lies. And, you know, and then we find the situation we're in. He just got more and more overextended, and the lies got to be deeper and deeper, apparently. And, you know, that is what, you know, brought him to the situation. But I don't think it says that we've got a problem with demand for rental housing in Rochester. In fact, you know, all evidence to the contrary.
Okay. And I lied. One more question then for you. And I'm going to ask you the same question I asked the economist on the phone with us, Evan Mast, this morning. When you're in the room with policymakers, if this research is strong and compelling, there's a lot of policymakers who are concerned about, quote, affordable housing, and for good reason. We understand why. But what would you say to policymakers? Are you overly focused on one area, not focused enough on another? Are policymakers in our community getting it right, or are they missing some things?
I thought the housing market study that was done in 2018 for the city was very good. And I think it points to a range of issues that we have to tackle, and they vary by market. That it does a really good job of segmenting the market and offering specific recommendations for each end of the market. And what you do for the bottom of the market, for those houses that are teetering on vacancy, teetering on demolition, is very different from what you're going to do to stabilize the market in the middle, and very different from what you're going to do to help improve the markets that are actually pretty healthy and are poised to expand. So it's a combination of things. And honestly, I think that most people really understand that supply matters. And that's why we try to encourage that as cities, and that's why we're providing incentives for developers to build more housing that we think is appropriate.
There should just be classes called supply and demand, right? Where for 8 weeks, you come into class at supply and demand,
That's right. Just keep repeating.
Don Riley, the vice president of Mark IV Enterprises. And Don, I'm glad you're here. Why don't you kind of give us a little bit of an overview of what Mark IV is doing right now, and how you see this question on if a community gets oversaturated with housing and where you think Rochester is.
Sure. The past is prologue, so let me just take you quickly through.
Right on your mic,
yeah, yeah, let me take you quickly through Mark IV, since it's a family business, that Rochester-born family business. Tony DiMarzo started the firm 53 years ago. And the reason I mention that is that he started from scratch, but he also has survived recession after recession after recession. Can you imagine in the past 53 years? And every time there's a recession, Evan, a lot of your developers disappear. And they disappear for economic reasons. They're either land poor, they have too much land, they're extended, they've oversaturated market, and so bad choices, and so on and so forth. So he's had a remarkable run at 53 years, and now the kids are in the business. He's built single-family homes, apartments, senior living communities, the 10 legacy communities, commercial properties, Cornhill Landing. Most of Cornhill townhomes were built by Tony DiMarzo, including his office. We've quietly been a corporate presence on Exchange Boulevard for our corporate headquarters for years. I spent half of my life in government and now half in the private sector, and I've had to learn and watch how he has selected and chosen to go into certain building of residential properties. And in the city, he saw the potential of Cornhill, and so working with the city and the community, I mean, he literally, by his building over 300 townhomes in his own headquarters, stabilized Cornhill, and thus allowed the rest of that community to develop. But in more recent days, every time we do a project, whether it was the H.H. Warner building that's now apartments, lofts and apartments, whether it's 300 Alexander, whether it's 625 Goodman, we have to demonstrate to the lending institutions the flow of cash and the run-up period for occupancy and all that goes with it. In the city of Rochester and in most communities, there's a requirement that a percentage of the occupants be quote-unquote low income. So we work with the Rochester Housing Authority and other entities who qualify and guarantee the rent. So those are all mixed, even those luxury, so-called luxury communities. I think it's 80-20 in the case of the new project at 625. Whether or not it has the effect that the author has talked about of allowing people to move from the space they're in to a more up in terms of space or amenities that they currently don't have, I'm not so sure the science is complete on that. But it sure does work that way with office space. When A space becomes available, B moves up to A, C moves up to B, and so on and so forth. And I think that same dynamic is going on with residential rental properties. These renters that we have are renters of choice. They're seniors who don't want to start another mortgage. There are people who really want to be part of the regrowth of the city. They're downsizing. They're students. They're temporary athletes moving through the community. Those Cornhill Landing is a perfect example. That is a complete mix of socioeconomic examples. It's not luxury. Luxury is used as a term to say we have new amenities, we're using better fixtures.
Well, like 625 Goodman, right?
Yeah.
I saw the sign. It says luxury.
And yes, it will be.
Okay.
But in Steve DiMarzo, that's his project. He was embraced by the community over there in a big way. They got behind it.
Who's they?
Swilberg community, the neighborhood associations, I mean, they really encouraged it and were part of it and were very much interested in what it would look like and the whole nine yards. And
could you describe the project, by the way? Because for listeners, if you've driven by it, you've seen it in progress now. It's right off 490 at Goodman. But how big, give me the scale of it.
Yeah, it's 100 units. And to give you a scale, Cornhill Landing is 127 units. So it's comparable to Cornhill Landing.
How many floors? How tall?
There's four stories. There will be, obviously, one bedroom, two bedroom, three bedroom. There will be some vistas on the top of the community for views downtown. There's community rooms. There's rooms for those people who live there to store their bikes and those kinds of amenities that we see in the urban community. It's a wonderful location. That was a leftover gore in the real estate world, a leftover piece of land from when they built the expressway. And there it sat. Historically, there were print shops. There were a few other businesses on that site. We're right behind John Betlem, and I think there's a bar, Evan, that you may be familiar with. The Hungry Goat is over there.
Yeah, I'm familiar with the Hungry
Goat. You're familiar with it?
Yeah.
Okay, I just wondering. And the Cinema Theater.
Now, so, what's the rental range expected for these?
They started
Kent's doing my job. That's good.
They started about $1,000 and on up.
$1,000 for a one bedroom?
$1,000 for one bedroom.
On up to what?
Probably $1,500, $1,600, maybe a tad more, but. We've had those same scale rentals. By the way, if I can, I don't want to get into the Morgan thing too much, but he must have had a different set of bankers keeping track of him because our bankers are very conscientious. We can't write a lease that doesn't fulfill the financial bank obligation. Do you understand? We can't give you rent, even if you're a close personal friend. That lease has to support itself. And so maybe Morgan allegedly, but there were other layers involved in that thing, and it's going to come tumbling down.
I think there's a lot that's going to come to light here. And you can understand, Don, why it's going to take this community a while before a listener who hears you say that say, oh, we believe Don. Bob probably would have come clean if Evan would have asked him. Everybody says what you just said.
Yeah, well, I got to tell you, when that news broke, I was talking to my boss, and I said, the next day, I said, the president of the banks that are holding paper are on the phone with their local presidents, and their local presidents are on the phone with their lending officers and saying, are we current? What's going on? And so on and so forth. So that had a ripple effect.
So at 625, 100 total units, going to open when?
We should be open in this early spring of this coming year.
Okay, 2020. And you are, obviously, the sign says you're currently accepting applications. How many you got filled so far?
I'll bet you we have a waiting list of upwards of probably half. I mean,
I have no idea what is typical at this point. I mean, you're almost a year out still.
Oh, so the run.
I don't know what's normal for when you want to be filling it.
It takes 6 months to a year to fill after you're done.
After you're open?
Yeah, you have to be able to finance projects through quite a period of time. There's not a line of people waiting outside. There's a lot of shopping.
Yeah.
The big question that we all have, though, even the industry, is how much is enough? And when the question was asked to some extent by the author, when are you full?
In a community.
And that's a very complicated dynamic to follow. I can cite in the 70s, Evan, the apartment owners in Monroe County sued all the communities they lived in because of vacancy rates. They brought certiorari proceedings. I was the supervisor of Greece at the time. They all said, we've got great vacancies and you have to lower our assessments. That will probably be the tipping point, and it may be a tipping point a little late to do anything about it, when the apartment owners and the property owners are appealing their assessments and complaining about 10, 15, 20, 30% vacancies.
All right, so your project, the Mark IV project, right off 498 Goodman, 625 Goodman is what it's called. How much help have you gotten from the city on it?
Tremendous cooperation.
But what kind of subsidy?
I don't believe we had any subsidies other than, I don't believe there were any real subsidies on that project at all.
What's a real subsidy?
A grant, a loan, a huge loan of some kind. Morgan apparently got a loan on the project next to the barbecue place.
This is all your money. This is not taxpayer money.
It's all our money.
Okay. Pilot agreement?
Yeah, any tax agreement? Yeah.
No.
No?
No.
Okay. Did you ask for a tax agreement?
I don't believe we did, no.
I mean, it doesn't seem that hard to get those things in this community. Why didn't you ask?
No. We like to be independent. We like
Give
to finance
break,
things
Don
as best we can.
What am I missing here?
The city may have provided the land. That was a piece of property that the city had as a piece of land.
So the city gave you the land?
They may have titled it to us, yes.
Okay. I
honestly don't know the exact details. I don't want to be misleading. But
I hear you. But the reason I'm asking is because if these projects do well, I think, you know, generally speaking, based especially on the study that we've talked about, there could be a very largely a good effect in the community. The concern now is people looking at Bob Morgan and they're going, if this thing fails, who's holding the bag here? You are?
Yeah, the city could be holding the bag.
No, I'm saying...
Oh, our project?
Yeah.
We have never had a project that failed, ever. Ever.
And starting at 1,000, I mean, you know, that's not that... That's pretty good.
It's a good start, and it's one that we've seen at Cornhill Landing. But let me describe Cornhill Landing as a project. A public-private partnership. A lot of them are criticized. Canal Corporation rebuilt the wall along the river that was where it is. So they built where thousands and thousands of people walk along the river. The city had that land through a foreclosure. It had been factories. As somebody told me, a tobacco storage factory at one time. There was a railroad siding. It was a cinder, empty overflow parking lot. The city had the land. We invested $20-some million dollars. Canal Corporation, I spent several million to rebuild the wall. And so the investment was $20 million on our part. Whatever the city valued the land with, it was a challenged piece of property. We had to build structures that went down 18, 19 feet to support the property. So a little investment by the Canal Corporation, the state of New York, the city had the land, and we invested over $20 million. you've got a very successful project.
Why with 625 Goodman, why didn't you pay for the land? Why did the city have to give it to you?
I'm not so sure they gave it to us. I really need to check that out.
Okay. What do you think it would have cost you to buy the land?
Not very much. It was a challenged piece of property. It was in real estate you call it a gore. It's on Carja Street. It's a tight little piece. Probably not good for much.
So the leverage you have is you can say to the city, look, you don't want that property looking like that forever. We'll do something with us. Give us the land.
Yeah,
that's the leverage you have. But if your company's doing well, why don't you just pay for it?
We take advantage of every opportunity to reinvest, and we've invested deeply in the city, and our headquarters is in the city. I don't think generally philosophically government should be in the real estate business, but it is, and it's not going to get out of the real estate business. If they can get a reliable developer to redevelop an abandoned piece of property and put it on the tax rolls, that's a pretty good deal.
Yeah, I understand the point you're making, and our
Comedia. What do they call it now?
Imagine Monroe.
Yeah, it's highly criticized, and I don't think they've done a good job of defending themselves in.
Well, they don't talk to us, so.
Yeah, but they. You know, most of the deals that I've seen are pretty defendable deals.
Well, the one other question I've got for Don, and then we'll go to break here, because I've got Jeff on Twitter saying, this sounds like advertising for Mark IV.
Thank you.
Don, that's what Don wants it to be.
That's
that is not
what
I want it to be. So I want to ask you very directly about this, because you brought up Comedia, now Imagine Monroe.
Yeah.
You talked about what Mark IV, the decisions you make when you're thinking about creating something like 625
yeah.
Goodman. One of the arguments is, well, we get these pilots, we get these tax
yeah.
agreements, we get
yeah.
sometimes subsidies, because otherwise we wouldn't do the project. And you got a lot of skeptics who go, baloney.
Yeah.
You're making a lot of money.
Yeah.
You would do this project anyway. You know, whether it's a new restaurant in a previously closed place, whether it's
yeah.
a new apartment complex, you'd
yeah.
do it. So why not just pay for it? Why ask for pilot agreements? You say because you ask because you can get them.
The county has used it. The county, both in Republican and Democratic administrations, Tom Fry was there for 4 years, used it as a way of encouraging job growth, and that is the trading of a temporary investment on the part of the county for the expansion of jobs is a good one. Where it gets criticized is they don't create jobs. They just take the tax breaks.
Well, yeah, damn right.
That's
a very valid criticism,
and
that's, isn't it?
And anytime we've used Comedia, and we used Comedia with the 10 senior living communities that we built, Legacy, and we created 50 real jobs at every single one of them, and that's something that—
You delivered on your promise.
We did.
So your comment to me tells me that your company— has
yeah.
followed through,
yeah.
But otherwise, these IDAs are way too loose with what they're handed out.
I think they're too loose, and they should tighten them up. It shouldn't be automatic money. And I mean, there was a law firm when Comedia started out years ago, that got millions of dollars for computers, and it can't be jobs that they'd have anyway. You're saying, would you build it without it? And I'm not so sure that that's the case. I think that a pilot agreement allows for an investment over 10 years, or in some cases they're longer, and that really allows you to get your feet underneath the project. But not all projects should automatically qualify. There's too much of that automatic qualification.
Okay. Kent, how do you feel about that?
You know, I think that it's important to answer what we, you know, have traditionally called the but-for question.
Yep.
And the but-for question says, but for this particular investment on the part of the public sector, whether it's a pilot or whether it's an outright grant, that this project would not move forward. And that's where you were going with that, Evan. And I think that Imagine Monroe, Comedia, over its history, has done a lot of projects that would have happened anyway. I mean, I think about hotels, motels. I did some analysis some years ago. I looked at hotels, motels built in Monroe County for 10 years. Not a single one of them went through without a pilot agreement. And, you know, you're not telling me that you're going to build a hotel because the hotel is going to bring more money to Rochester. People are coming to Rochester for another reason, need to stay someplace. And I think if you build a hotel and you subsidize it, that subsidized hotel is just displacing hotel rooms someplace else. So I think those are absolutely inappropriate. I think the same thing's true for medical offices. I mean, the classic example is years ago they financed my dentist to move from one side of Irondequoit to the other side of Irondequoit. It was the tax break. It was the sales tax abatement on the equipment, the whole nine yards. And I thought that was completely inappropriate. Now,
you told your dentist this, the guy who drills your teeth?
I actually did after, and I've left after I said that. I thought it was important.
It's wise.
Yeah, I thought so too. There are still a lot of medical office buildings that are done with support. There are a lot of general office buildings. And I think that's probably in the same category, that if you build an office building that's going to be filled with, whomever you find to fill it, I don't see why that property deserves a tax abatement.
All right, let's get our only break of the hour. We're going to come back. We'll take some listener questions as we talk about development in our community. There's a City Lab piece that caught our attention that takes a look at the possible impacts across a long chain of income levels in a community like Rochester when we see more higher-end units built. You just heard Kent Gardner, economist with the Center for Governmental Research, the chief economist there, and Don Riley, vice president of Mark IV Enterprises. Let's get that break and come back to your feedback next. Coming up in our second hour, you've probably heard someone say that they find meaning in their religion, in their faith, in the hope of an afterlife and everlasting life. But a new book from Swedish philosopher Martin Hägglund argues that atheists need to take up more ground talking about meaning, meaningfulness of life in the here and now. And we talk about it next hour. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Kent Gardner, just can you kind of polish up a point you were making during the break? There are certain projects also that might you think don't always have a return on investment, or at least a tell me a little bit about that.
Well, I think gently pushing back on my fellow guest here, I don't know that senior living facilities would fit in my list either. I guess that, again, the question economists want to ask is whether there is new money coming into the community as a consequence of the development. We generally exclude retail developments and most service developments when we're looking at that list.
Yeah.
You're going to build a Costco, for example. When you build Costco, are we actually having more retail sales in Rochester because we've got a Costco, or is it just going to come from, it's going to come from, Walmart and from, these other retailers? So by and large, we tend to exclude those. And I think, when you're looking at a senior living community, I think the same argument can be made.
Well, it's tempting to, since there's an automaticity to the CMITA or whatever it's called now.
Imagine Monroe.
To just apply for it and take a shot at it, whether or not it's expanding jobs. But
well, I completely agree. I think the fault is really with the Imagine Monroe board.
I think it's bigger than I don't think it's the board. I think it's a philosophy. I don't think government should be in the real estate business at all. In fact, I don't think government should own any buildings. I think they should rent everything and keep that on the tax rolls.
Sure, but there is a role for incentives. I think it's impossible not to play the incentives game to some degree. And if someone comes in and suggests they're going to build a manufacturing plant here with 200 jobs, I think there's a reason for us to play a role as a public sector.
There's a much more specific way to do it though than CMITA. I did an incentive deal when I was with Greece with Kodak with Canal Ponds. And that was a transparent agreement between, because Kodak had brought a certiorari proceeding against the town.
And a big one, I seem to remember.
And instead of getting in a peeing contest like Webster did, I said, let's get everybody around the table and figure it out. And we did. And, Kodak was still Kodak when that happened. And were we bailing them out? Well, to retain them, to keep 40,000 jobs at the time, I think that was a role for government. But I think it ought to be individual, specific, and it ought to be you could use taxation. You could use a lot of things short of this sort of automatic sales tax, sales break.
And property tax. Yes.
Yeah.
Right.
Use the assessment, existing assessment procedures, and grow and measure that. Have an actual transparent. The Kodak exchange on Canal Ponds was transparent and dramatic and allowed Kodak to
That was a good deal between, because both of you had a problem. Kodak had a problem, and you had a problem.
Well,
and you navigated that, I think, quite well.
Kodak used to hand us their assessments because we had no way of assessing their property, and then they sued us on their own assessments. I thought that was kind of humorous.
It's a little more complicated than that. I seem to remember, Don. But
yeah. Well, let me get some listener feedback. Judy says, "I've been wondering about where all these new residents downtown will work, since so many of the office buildings have been turned into luxury housing. Three buildings I worked in after college are now apartments or condos. Doesn't seem to be any jobs around town, though." Kent, what would you say to that?
Well, I think that a lot of the places that have been converted, these are the low end, the Class C office buildings, or their office buildings that were completely vacant. So a lot of the housing, and take a look at Sibley, for example. I mean, that Sibley sat pretty much vacant for a very long time. So most of the housing, again, Don, you're closer to this than I am, but I believe most of the housing has gone into places that were not actually office properties when they were converted. And so certainly we do need to see more people working downtown, but I don't think that people moving downtown are necessarily working downtown. I mean, I think there's a really nice symbiotic thing going on with people coming downtown, living downtown, and still working perhaps out in the burbs.
Absolutely.
Ray wants to know, what happens to all the people of color who live on Goodman and live in those areas near where Don is talking about, near their new building? What happens when they get moved out of their community because they can't afford their homes anymore? He's talking about gentrification.
I remember Michener wrote about gentrification in Philadelphia a million years ago. I remember reading that. This is not gentrification. This actually fits, and no one's being displaced at all since there's nothing there now. And it may change some of the availability of. There's nothing on
no,
the
no,
site.
No, no, no. On the
I
site
understand.
Itself. We're
I
talking
understand.
About the neighborhoods around.
Yeah.
What Ray's concerned about are the people who have lived there for a long time.
I think I don't want to respond on Don's behalf, but I think a property like this, a multifamily, and this isn't, I mean, this isn't luxury in the sense that we think of you know, real luxury apartments. I think a development like this actually enhanced property values in a residential neighborhood like that Goodman Street. I drive along that road all the time, and I think that this property, this development will certainly not diminish property values. So I think Ray is probably incorrect in this score.
No, I think what Ray thinks is if you keep cranking up those property values, eventually people can't pay the taxes and they're forced out.
Okay, I'm sorry. I think, but again, I don't think it's going to make a huge difference to this particular market.
All I can tell you is the first occupants of anything new that's built, not only us but others, are people who from the area. They actually are attracted to maybe taking a step up. So I think the first people that move in will be neighbors to the project currently.
And typically, multifamily in a single-family neighborhood, if there's a direction, it reduces property values for those single-family homes. So, I don't think that's going to happen in this case because of the nature of the property, because of the nature of the neighborhood. But again, I think that Ray's fears are inappropriate in this case. I think he's wrong about that.
Okay.
But it certainly does happen. But it's a great challenge of gentrification. You can't improve the quality of the neighborhood without making the neighborhood more desirable. That was the point. And if you make a neighborhood more desirable, one of the outcomes is that it sometimes becomes more expensive. It's a real problem.
I think our caller would be absolutely right on if there had been demolition of some of the neighborhood itself, rather than infill, if you will. When Robert Moses, blasted through beautiful multicultural neighborhoods in New York, they've never recovered with his expressways and highways and that. This is infill, so to speak, and I think very positive.
Ginny wants to know, why do the owners of Mark IV and other developers give so much money to candidates for local government?
Because we're solicited by those candidates.
So you wouldn't give the money if they didn't ask you for it.
Bingo.
Get out of here. Come on.
There's no, let me tell you, having been on the solicitation end myself as a candidate, you have no idea how many fundraisers people have. We support both parties.
You support anybody who's got the power.
No, we support.
Yes.
No. I have a boss who will not give money to people he don't think are doing a good job or good people. I'm not kidding you.
Well, I suppose you're not going to give money to Alex White or people who are against a lot of the development that we
I'm not inviting him to call on us, but he's never called us.
Okay. So, but do you expect a return on the investment when you give to political candidates? No?
No. No.
So why give money?
We believe they have the potential to be in very good office holders.
Okay.
No, I'm serious. You know, I know a little bit about that side of the equation. And most of these people are pretty decent people. But no, there's no...
This is the chicken and egg debate. Ginny's sort of feeling like you give money because you want a return on the investment. What Don's saying is we give money because they've already told us this is what how we're going to govern, and we like the way they're going to govern.
We think they're good at what they're doing. They're decent. They're honest. We don't have... It may sound Pollyannish, but I've been on the asking end as a candidate and served 8 terms. And I used to go out and ask people to support me, whether it was Jim Wilmot or whether it was you. And I'd say, if you think I'm doing a good job, I need your support. You know, campaigns are expensive.
And I think developers do vary a lot in terms of their perspective on this. I think, you know, you've got some people who are given big money who really do expect a return. And I do think that the amount of money that goes into political campaigns from the whole development industry, property owners, you know, and property developers is probably inappropriate. And I do think that as a group, they wield a lot of power in Albany, surely.
Do you agree with that, Don? Is there too much money from developers in politics?
I think Albany and Washington have been corrupted and corroded by the amount of money, not only coming from lobbyists, but the amount of money that government spends, billions. And where there's that kind of money being spent at our level, I have not found a level of corruption that I've been even slightly uncomfortable with. But we will not do business with an entity that we think is corrupt.
Okay. Do you think some developers give money to political candidates because they want a return on that investment?
You know, we all have heard the expression pay to play, haven't we? Do I think there's pay to playing? I think both parties may very well engage in that, but we certainly wouldn't.
Don, this is like an education, I think. This hour, you've sort of indicted Comita, or now Imagine
Monroe. I didn't indict it.
Well,
I just
don't
like the way it
works. They're a little loose. Yeah, you don't like the way they're kind of making their decisions.
And they are.
But every decision that's ever benefited Mark IV has been above board. And that sometimes money can corrupt politics, but never the money that you give.
No, I'm. You asked me, and I gave you responses.
Oh, I appreciate that. I appreciate that. So here's one more quick question. This comes from a listener who says, so then what actually defines luxury? That term has been used a lot. How do you define what luxury means?
The amenities, the finishes, the
There's not a legal
space.
Term, though, right? That's a subjective term.
I don't think
term.
So, no. I think it's a marketing term more than anything.
But for Mark IV, it means what?
It means very nice amenities, space, finishes, you know, closets, beautiful spaces, well thought out and well designed, comfortable.
Tiana says gentrification is more than knocking down buildings and literal displacement. There are people who live on or near Goodman that this will affect.
I think probably in a very positive way. I don't think in a negative way. Kent pointed out something that is not always supportable by appraisals, that an apartment community will denigrate the value of residential property. That's an individual appraisal.
Yeah, you know, my only point, Don, is that that's if it's going to go a direction, I think single family homeowners often view multifamily negatively.
They do,
and if they view it negatively, and the next person who comes to buy their house views it negatively, it can have that effect. I'm not saying it does in this case.
Well, then they know what they're buying.
Well, but that doesn't change the facts. If it's perception, it can translate into market value.
In our last 90 seconds, so is Rochester? Do you think Rochester is close at all to reaching that level of saturation? I mean, is Mark IV going to keep doing these kind of projects? Do you think we're going to hit the wall with high-end housing?
When we're done, everybody else should stop building apartments. No, I'm not sure, Evan. I really don't know the answer to that. But when we look at a project, it has to be financeable, supportable, and achievable. And at some point, there's going to be a limit to how much rental housing is available in the city.
Okay. Ken, how do we measure it? Are we getting close?
I haven't the faintest idea, Evan. It's a really hard thing to tell. I think a lot of us who've been watching the market say, well, that building filled. That's great. And we've got a developer who is, you know, Mark IV is building this building on Goodman. And, you know, they've been in business a long time, and they seem to know their stuff. And if that building fills, well, that's great. But I think we keep watching building by building.
I want to thank our guests for the hour. Thanks for taking the time to be here. Don Riley is the Vice President of Mark IV Enterprises. Don, thank you. Nice having you here.
Yeah, you keep getting me in trouble every time I come on. Thank you, Evan. I appreciate it.
Well, that's because, to answer Jeff's point from earlier, I'm not just here for an advertisement for you. But you keep saying yes. Thank you.
Yeah, you bet.
We'll see you again.
No
Kent
problem.
Gardner is the chief economist with the Center for Governmental Research, who's been getting lots of people in trouble for many years. Thank you, Kent.
It's my business. Thanks.
Thank you. More Connections coming up next.